Hi, we're Josh
and Arielle Wamsley,
owners of Green Valley Tree LLC, based in North Windham.
We're proud to sponsor Connecticut East this week and to serve the communities of Windham and New London counties with our tree removal and plant healthcare services.
Visit our website at greenvalleytreeworks.com for a full list of our services or give us a call on 860-234-4041. We look forward to hearing from you.
It's a year since Governor Lamont set up the PFAS task force and created an action plan over forever chemicals in the state. So what has the task force done since then? We talked to two of the agencies to find out. Plus a look at other stories making the headlines from around the region. This is Connecticut East This Week. Hello, I'm Brian Scott Smith. It's now a year since Governor Lamont set up the PFAS task force here in Connecticut and agreed an action plan. It all started after 50,000 gallons of firefighting chemicals were accidentally discharged into the Farmington River from Bradley International Airport. These chemicals, known commonly as PFAS or forever chemicals, pose not only environmental issues, but health issues too. But a wider study of PFAS here in Connecticut has shown these chemicals are present almost everywhere, and especially around military bases and fire schools that use firefighting foam, and around landfill where for years consumer products like pizza boxes, textiles, non-stick pots and pans that also contain PFAS have been buried, and now that is seeping out into our rivers and waterways, and more importantly, into our drinking water. The most alarming aspect of all of this is that little is known about how toxic these chemicals really are on our health, and although the Environmental Protection Agency has set limits of how much PFAS they believe is acceptable, they simply don't know for certain. With COVID-19 very much in the picture still, I spoke to two of the agencies that form the multi-agency PFAS task force here in Connecticut to find out what they've been up to since last year. I spoke with Laurie Matthew, the Drinking Water Branch Chief at the Department of Public Health, and Ray Friggin, the Assistant Director of the Remediation Division at the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, or DEEP. Laurie, I want to turn to you first. Where are we at with, you know, work that has been done, you know, since the formation of the task force and obviously the document that was presented by the PFAS task force to the governor?
Thank you, Brian. It's a great question. At the end of last year, the task force submitted its action plan to the governor back in November of 2019. There were quite a few actions within that plan, and it was broken up into three segments. One was public health focused, and myself and my colleague Brian Toll were the co-chairs of the public health committee. And I will speak to those items that are within public health and the priorities that came of it. There were quite a few, about 10 or 12 priority items that were brought forward within the action plan. Of those, the top priorities became a number of different things. One was to create recommendation was to create a safe drinking water advisory council in the state of Connecticut. We do not have a council that would provide advice or recommendations to the Department of Public Health on setting a maximum contaminant level in drinking water. Other states, as we went through the task force process, we've seen that other states are very knowledgeable about what other states are doing around us that have these councils, where if EPA is not taking action on setting an MCL, then these councils would advise, like New York and New Jersey and also New Hampshire and other states have these councils. We do not. So the action was to create a council. Since that time, we have worked with various leaders within state government to move forward and take steps. Obviously, with COVID in mid-March, we have, as an agency, have turned our attention to COVID and COVID mitigation management. And it's not that PFAS has been at all forgotten about. We have staff that continuously work on the efforts of knowing and understanding where we should be and continuously work with our colleagues at DEEP on thinking about what are the next steps. But we have continued the effort to move forward with a council. the legislative session being canceled in March as well. That has slowed down a couple of our efforts as well. But right now we're picking up the momentum. Over the summer, we have continued to meet with our colleagues at DEEP and are continuing the planning toward standing up a council as first envisioned by the task force. I don't have the specifics. I don't have the dates. I don't have all of those, but maybe a few months from now, I will have more details. But we are moving forward in that direction. Also, we are, and what we had been planning back in March was to purchase equipment for the state laboratory. The Department of Public Health has an oversight of the state laboratory. We do not have the equipment at the state laboratory to test for PFAS, and we wish to purchase that equipment. So we are continuing to move forward in that effort as well. And we are also mindful that when we purchase the equipment and we also move forward with a council, that there are some resources that are necessary for the health department to move forward with those efforts. There are many, many other items within the action plan under public health that are very important to move forward with, and we are mindful of all of them. But those are the top two that come to my mind at this moment in time and that we are planning to move forward this fall.
Laurie, thanks ever so much for that. And I think everybody understands that, you know, having seen, obviously, that action plan, as you say, there are many recommendations, and it's going to take an inordinate length of time, I'm sure, to really get into this, because this is a very, very historic problem, not just for Connecticut, but it's clearly for the entire United States. Ray, I want to turn to you now, obviously, on behalf of DEEP. You also have action points as well. One of the big ones that really came out of this, and I suppose which really started this, was this foam, this firefighting foam that is used at places like airports and some fire departments. And of course, unfortunately found its way into the Farmington River in quite a large quantity. There is this, I understand, a requirement to try and take back this this foam and replace it with something else, which hopefully is a lot less sort of like damaging, not only to the environment, but also to people as well. Where is DEEP with that?
So, Brian, that's one of our most significant initiatives that we're pushing forward on right now is the take back of the aqueous film forming foam, also known as AFFF. And at this point in time, AFFF can be found in nearly every fire department across the state, both on a municipal and state level, as well as our airports across the state. And the product does an amazing job at suppressing fires. But of course, we need to get this material off the streets to protect our environment. And one of the key things that we have been looking at is an alternative to AFFF. So we have been engaging with a number of vendors out there that are providing a so-called green alternative to AFFF. We have identified a couple of products that we believe will act nearly the same as the PFAS containing AFFF, yet not contain the PFAS component within it. So again, that testing is in the latter stages of wrapping up, and we hope to be providing a identifier of the actual product that should substitute for the PFAS containing AFFF. And we're doing that in coordination with other states in our region, as well as the Department of Emergency Services and Public Protection.
Another thing I wanted to put to you, Ray, is also toxics in, so like packaging as well, because another big area of concern is that PFAS and its variants, you know, appear in all sorts of everyday items as well. Where is the state with that in trying to reduce some of the toxics in the packaging that we all use?
So our folks in our Waste Engineering and Enforcement Division are networking with other waste management officials across the nation on a toxics and packaging potential legislative package. There's a clearinghouse. I don't recall the exact name of the organization, but there is an organization across the United States that is networking with state officials from the state environmental officials to identify what types of packaging may harbor the PFAS contaminant and proposing some legislation that may or may not be brought up in Connecticut in the future.
One of the other things I want to raise with you, Ray, and this is, you know, one of your areas of specialism, and that's remediation. I mean, this stuff is everywhere. It isn't, as we said at the top of this interview, it isn't just a Connecticut problem. This is, it's a worldwide problem. So how do you go about remediating something like this, which is, it's huge and obviously, you know, is borderless as well?
That's exactly right, Brian. This is a very challenging contaminant for sure. One of the key things that we are working on and that we have been working on for months now since the issuance of the action plan is requiring sites that are undergoing cleanup today as we speak, sites that may have PFAS as part of their product stream, their waste stream. We are asking those entities to also look for PFAS as part of the contaminants of concern for those sites. Where we have found PFAS has been at training facilities where the AFFF foam has been used, in operations that use solvents, plating, for instance, where PFAS is used as a mist suppressing agent for the plating baths, and where those plating liquids have escaped and impacted our environment, so has the PFAS along with it. So we're making efforts in that regard to assess sites that are undergoing cleanup throughout the state as we speak. As far as the actual cleanup of this material, the options at this point in time are rather limited. We are networking with folks from across the nation and most notably within the New England region, as we all have this, we are aligned with the goal to reduce PFAS impacts, to manage the environmental fallout from this contaminant and remediate in a cost-effective and environmentally sustainable manner.
I want to put this question to you because it's something that sort of I've been thinking about. This is dangerous stuff. We all acknowledge that. How do you actually safely contain it? I mean, you know, when it comes to remediation, where do you then put it and in a safe manner so that it doesn't get back, obviously, into the environment again? Can you explain that? Because it's almost, I don't want to sound alarmist, but it's almost like radioactive material. I mean, it needs to be put away safely somewhere so that it doesn't harm anyone. I mean, this is almost a similar sort of situation because this is why it's got its name Forever Chemicals, isn't it?
That is absolutely correct. And that's the million-dollar question. Where do we put this material? At this point in time, we have a very limited number of options until the technology catches up with the emergence of this contaminant. We're kind of in a waiting game. So again, we're networking with our counterparts in other states to identify the most appropriate and sustainable means to sequester this material in place. So one of those options is just that, sequestering in place. So yeah, we are networking with a number of other states as to the technologies that they are utilizing to either contain or remediate this particular contaminant in a variety of environmental media. So we're talking about the contaminant PFAS in drinking water, for example. We do have means and methods to remove this contaminant. Granular activated carbon is one of them. We have various proprietary membranes that are coming out, as well as resins that can retain the PFAS contaminant. However, those resins, membranes, and granular activated carbon then contain the PFAS chemical and in and of themselves need to be disposed of at some point in time, given the longevity of the filter based on the volume concentration of contaminant that's being removed. At this point in time, incineration has been shown to be very effective at fully destroying the PFAS chemical. However, we have a concern about the air emissions from those incineration plants. In Connecticut, we do not have an authorized incinerator. our closest neighbor in New York State was incinerating. There's currently a moratorium on incineration in New York State, at least in one county in New York. We are working with individuals from US EPA to come up with the appropriate technology to evaluate the emissions for PFAS from these incineration plants to ensure that they are, in fact, destroying the PFAS contaminant with the solid matrix that it is arriving at, as opposed to maybe partially destroying the contaminant and allowing a portion to be emitted in a gaseous form through the stack emissions.
This is a very challenging situation, clearly, for all of you who are involved in this, you know, DEEP, DPH, all the other agencies. I just wanted to quickly put a point to Laurie as well. You know, how do you deal with a situation, Laurie, where even the EPA are saying we're not quite sure what the maximum contaminant levels in public water, what the safe levels are? This must be incredibly challenging and difficult for you as an agency when even the EPA is saying, hey, we don't know.
Brian, that's a great point. And that's why the task force believed under the public health item that an advisory council needed to be stood up to deal with the review of the state of Connecticut for the first time setting a maximum contaminant level on our own. And given what we know of and what we've been paying close attention to around the country, as Ray mentioned, you know, and we have to work with our state counterparts because of the lack of action by EPA in this regard, in particular for setting an MCL. What has taken place around New England in particular and New York and New Jersey is they have stepped out into the area, into the arena of setting MCLs. This is not something that states are used to doing. This is not our normal work. This is typical of EPA and the Safe Drinking Water Act since 1974. EPA sets the national levels and the states work to incorporate that into the state regulations and then work to work on compliance and work on enforcement with the state's public water system under the Safe Drinking Water Act. Well, because EPA is not taking that definitive action on these particular chemicals and not moving fast enough, other states have moved very quickly, setting their own maximum contaminant levels or are in the near term will be setting those levels. That's why the council is important to us. We want to move that forward. We want to pull together subject matter experts in the fields of, you know, not only looking at the scientific information of toxicology, but also looking at, you know, effectiveness of treatment, effectiveness of the laboratory, you know, testing methods, and then affordability and all the other things that go along with setting a maximum contaminant level, which we're not used to doing.
Sure.
It is a mountain of a task because that is not our normal work. But we believe, based upon everything that we put together under the task force, that these chemicals deserve the attention. In Connecticut, there are over 2,500 public water systems. There are over 325,000 private wells. Testing needs to continue on and move forward. And that's another action under public health that's within the task force report was ongoing and short-term actions was testing of drinking water for PFAS. And that is our effort and trying to move that forward. We need a council. We need a council of subject matter experts stood up because the inaction of EPA and because we do know how this chemical is and that it is a threat to human health and that we have to take these steps that are not normal for the Department of Public Health in the state of Connecticut and setting maximum contaminant levels. So
let me put this final question to both of you. And again, thank you so much for, you know, what you're bringing by way of clarification about this very important work. Of course, people always expect, you know, government agencies to step in and do cleanup and whatever. And to a certain degree, you know, people have a right to expect that. However, is there anything that the public can do to help themselves, but also to help you?
One thing I would say is that people could certainly take a look at the action plan. It is not a 70-page document. It's a very quick read if they're interested in the details of what we had to say when we came together. But also, what could you do as an individual? You certainly could look to pay attention to the packaging of any of the food packaging that you purchase, or, you know, pay close attention to that. I think those are important items, you know, and know that, you know, that the state is moving forward with what we as the task force believe were important in the protection of public health and remediation and pollution prevention.
And I would just add to Lori's statement there, I would encourage the general population of the state to educate itself. The types of products where PFAS can be found, the typical uses of PFAS. Now, thankfully, PFAS use seems to be declining, at least with the longer chain chemical throughout the United States. So that's certainly good news, but definitely knowing where PFAS can be found, what products it may be within, and, you know, educating yourself as to, you know, what those products are so that you can make wiser choices as a consumer.
And that's a great point, Ray. And I don't think either one of us mentioned is our website. We have a very good website. We keep up to date. You can find the action plan there. You can find good information and links if you're at all interested in knowing more about what the state has done and what we plan to do. You know, that's a great a web page to take a look at.
Well, Lori and Ray from the state, from Department of Public Health and DEEP, thank you, as I say, ever so much for joining us on the podcast and giving us an update, obviously, on what is a Herculean task ahead for everybody, and something that we will be revisiting with you every now and again as, obviously, all of the agencies and the task force continue this very important role. But in the meantime, to you both, thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you, Brian. Appreciate your interest in this topic.
Thank you, Brian.
If you have questions or concerns about PFAS, then visit the DEEP website at ct.gov/DEEP and use the website search box and type in PFAS, that's P-F-A-S, and click on the link to the PFAS Task Force.
Green Valley Tree LLC is proud to sponsor Connecticut East This Week. Contact Green Valley Tree LLC for all your tree removal and plant health care needs and more. Find us at greenvalleytreeworks.com or call 860-234-4041.
Time now for a look at some of the other stories making the headlines in the region recently. In the Connecticut Examiner this week, Governor Lamont announced a statewide rollback to Phase 2 beginning on Friday, November 6th. Connecticut's positivity rate for the past 7 days is up, with 340 current hospitalizations due to the virus. Lamont said he was concerned about making sure that hospitals would have the capacity to both treat COVID patients and take care of patients with other ailments. Lamont also referenced regional neighbors such as Massachusetts and Rhode Island. Last Wednesday, Rhode Island's Governor Gina Raimondo said she was considering rolling back to Phase 2 if the number of COVID cases do not decrease. Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker instated a 9:30 p.m. curfew and a stay-at-home advisory. Restaurants in the state will be reduced to 50% capacity, and those that serve alcohol are required to close by 9:30 p.m. Event venues are limited to 25 people indoors and 50 people outdoors, and performing arts venues and movie theatres are capped at 100 people. Religious services are reduced to 50% capacity with a maximum of 100 people. In the day this week, the state saw very strong voter turnout in the election that was on track to at least rival 2016's high turnout, when about 77% of the state's registered voters cast a ballot. That's according to the Secretary of the State's office. As of 6 p.m. on Election Day, with 2 hours left until the polls closed, 70% of the state's 2.3 million registered voters had voted, said Gabe Rosenberg, spokesman for the Secretary of the State's office. That included 636,000 absentee ballots registered ahead of Election Day, but did not include Election Day registration votes or the absentee ballots not yet entered into the system. The state saw a high number of absentee ballots, as all voters had the option to vote by absentee ballot due to the pandemic. Polling places across the state saw lines which appeared long due to social distancing, but clearly there was an enthusiasm to come out and vote, according to officials. As of noon, the state had already reached 50% of voter turnout. In Norwich, dozens of voters had already lined up when election moderators arrived at the city's polling places, signalling the expected high turnout in the presidential election, even after 5,182 voters had submitted absentee ballots prior to the election day. As of 7 p.m, Norwich had a turnout of 73.5% of its total 20,123 registered voters as of October 29th, with 25% in absentee ballots. By comparison, in 2016, voter turnout was 74.99%. In the Norwich Bulletin this week, a Montville couple were charged with fracturing several of their three-month-old child's bones and failing to seek medical treatment for the baby's injuries, according to police. Joshua Morales, 26, and Diana Loomis, 20, were each charged with cruelty to persons and risk of injury to a minor. Morales was additionally charged with first-degree reckless endangerment and second-degree assault. Montville Police and the State Department of Children and Families began investigating the couple after learning a medical exam of the child showed healing fractures of two sets of ribs and a leg bone, according to a police press release. There was no indication in that release on when the alleged abuse occurred. Morales was initially held on a $50,000 bond and Loomis on a $30,000 bond. In the Middletown Press this week, with Middletown High School closed for 14 days after a student and teacher were diagnosed with COVID-19, contact tracing has identified about 82 students and 19 of their siblings, as well as 21 staff who are now in isolation, according to the education officials. There were 6 positive cases among students and 2 staff members, according to the district's COVID tracker. The siblings are at schools throughout the district, according to the Chief of School Operations and Communications. MHS was shuttered for 2 weeks because of the large number of staff being affected, officials said. According to the school's district COVID-19 tracker, which is regularly updated and chronicles cases at all 11 of the city's public schools as well as adult education district-wide, there were 225 individuals in quarantine after being in close contact with a positive individual and/or family member, 184 students and 41 staff. Of those, 95 at the high school, 54 at Woodrow Wilson Middle School, 19 at Moody Elementary School had the highest numbers of students self-isolating. And in the Chronicle this week, University of Connecticut personnel are currently investigating recent anti-Semitic incidents on the store's campus. The incidents, which happened on the South Campus, are being investigated through the university's bias incident protocol. Expectations of acceptable and unacceptable behavior are outlined in the university's policies, and violations can result in discipline up to and including separation from the university. In a letter from UConn, it stated recent anti-Semitic incidents involve physical damage to property, including swastika graffiti. There are undeniable symbols of anti-Semitism that elicit painful reminders of the Holocaust among our Jewish students, faculty, and staff, the letter states. These acts and other discriminatory acts this semester are deeply upsetting and leave a scar on members of our community whose beliefs or identities are targeted. And in next week's Connecticut East This Week, we talk with the new commissioner of the Department of Corrections, Angel Quiros, about how the DOC is handling COVID-19 cases in the state's prison system and comments he made about closing down prison and correctional facilities over the next few years. Plus, how have the arts fared during the continued COVID-19 pandemic? Like so many industries, it has had to seek new ways to attract visitors and customers to stay in business. We talk with the executive director of Goodspeed Opera House, Michael Gennaro, to find out how they have been faring. That's all from us for this edition. Do send us your questions and story ideas to the show via our website at connecticut-east.com or Facebook or Twitter at Connecticut East, where you can also listen to the show again on demand. And please like, follow, and share on your social media platforms too. I'm Brian Scott Smith. Thank you for listening.